now, Whom Pods Destroy.
Welcome to Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. I'm Terry, and as ever, I'm joined by Derek.
Hello.
And by Graham.
Hello.
Well, gents, truly we are in the middle of another golden age of Star Trek. As discussed in our last episode, we've had tremendous fun criticising the fantastic Star Trek Picard, and another season has already got the go-ahead, despite our criticisms. A third season of Star Trek Discovery is due out later this year as Michael Burnham and her crew forge a new future for the franchise. There's Lower Decks on the way, and it's a hearty congratulations to Gene Roddenberry. It may have taken 55 years, but finally the cage has been picked up for a full season. The new outing, Star Trek Strange New Worlds, reunites Captain Pike and the crew of the pre-Kirk Enterprise and keeps the franchise firmly rooted in the 23rd century, which means there's never been a better time to be a podcast that focuses on the Star Trek in that century. Of course, we could mope around complaining that modern Star Trek just isn't the same without rubber gaunt costumes and polystyrene masonry, but that's not our style. And to those who do, we say, leave your cynicism in your quarters. There's no room for it on the bridge. So let us go boldly with renewed vigour into our original series of Star Trek as we spend an agreeable half an hour or so discussing the Stonewall first season classic that is Balance of Terror. Gents, what can we say? What an episode this is, Graham. It's an absolute classic episode and a real flag in the ground as to what Star Trek stands for.
Yeah, it certainly is. You can be the most contrarian Star Trek fan of all and you still can say a bad word about this episode. No, you can't. There's no way. Even people who only ever watch Next Generation would look at this episode and say, yeah, there goes an episode. Far better than any of the crap that I like so much.
I loved it. I was really pleased that you chose this as the one to focus on this time. And it's been a long time since I've actually watched it. It's a brilliant episode. But as our remit, we're going to have this podcast and then we're going to criticize it. And then we're going to come out of it slightly disappointed.
Well,
No, we're not.
That may be your agenda, not my agenda. not for this one. It's a perfect example of the perfect Star Trek episode in that it's got action and suspense and adventure, but it also has underlying some pretty strong reasons as to why we shouldn't really be glorifying action, suspense and adventure. It's a clear post-war war film.
Oh, yeah.
Episode.
Yeah, certainly. It's very much an anti-war war film, isn't it? It's one of those anti-war war films. It's a really cracking war film as well, with lots and lots of action in there as well. Just so you recognise and go, yes, the futility of war. Oh, look at it. It's great though, isn't it?
It is great. Those are my favourite kinds of war movies. The one where we go, look at all these fantastic action scenes and exploding. Isn't it awful? Awfully good. Sticking with the themes as well. I mean, the chief theme, however, is obviously the character of Lieutenant Stiles. Paul Comey, the actor, plays Lieutenant Stiles. He's the main guest star of the show. He's the guy who has family from the old Romulan War and who is clearly, you know, carrying a few demons from that war that aren't his. And there's some really interesting ideas. A normal episode of Star Trek is they go to a planet and then they see them aliens doing things that have metaphor or mirror in some way issues that are in our current society. But in Balance of Terror, in fact, it's actually just one guy who happens to be on the bridge because it's just a ever so slightly expanded bottle episode. It's like a bottle episode, but with a little jar next to it as well. We see all of the message of the perils and the dangers of bigotry in this episode, all going through Dials.
This is a trek of many levels, but that's a lovely bit with Stiles. I mean, to understand the sort of like the American psyche at the time, I'm not too sure where was America in the Vietnam War at this time. It was very early on. Yeah. But I feel that it sort of has more resonance with obviously World War II or maybe even the Korean War, with the idea that there will be people who will have a lot of grievances against people of other races, you know, especially the Japanese after World War II. who, as an economic power, had started to make waves, and there was lots of imports into America, especially new technologies and stuff like this. And on the West Coast, the connection between Japan and the West Coast was starting to build up. You know, they'd always been there, but there was more interaction. And I suppose is that they would have seen, you know, there would have been people who, you know, as the writers of this. I'm not too sure about the much of the detail of the writers, which I'm sure you guys can actually expand upon. But they've obviously got this lovely little nugget, and you know, and they want to sort of like analyze sort of the people from that sort of generation and the grievances to people of other cultures who, you know, no fault of their own, like Spock himself, is the brunt of all of this hate and fear that's been carried down through the generations. And it is that anti-war story about taking a grievance further and further and further and passing it on to your children. You know, it's lovely how this has been set up, and it's all a lovely puzzle that's been constructed in an excellent way, and a great bit of entertainment.
Yeah, Graham, the interesting what Derek's saying there, it makes me think about Spock as kind of a metaphor for the Japanese internment. Do you think that there's either intentionally or unintentionally a bit of that going on there in this episode?
Maybe. I think it there is obviously sort of the whole thing of just tarring everyone with. Well, it's prejudice, isn't it? The most basic form of prejudice. You look like this person, therefore you must be these people. You've got the characteristics of it there. It's an interesting, because the episode doesn't need it, but it works well because it's there. And like the original series does confront prejudice quite a lot, or it actually explores it quite a few times. It's never really done this in your face, is it really? And it doesn't drag through the whole episode and get resolved at the end, which is a lovely thing, a lovely touch about it. Apart from the fact someone dies, but yeah, but yeah, you know what I mean. And so the fact that it is Spock that is sort of the brunt of the prejudice is quite good, because otherwise Spock doesn't get to do a lot in this episode other than just describe what debris just come out of the Romulan ship, and it adds a different dimension to it. But there is such good, everyone gets a little bit in this. Even the minor characters get a tiny bit, but a really really strong bit. It's like even as much as like Uhura just taking over the navigation console, and it's so well done that it allows them to use the ensemble in a way that a lot of episodes in the original series never did. I think you're still in that sort of first half of the first series where it's still finding its feet, and it's still allowing the other characters a bit more room to grow and expand. And that gets narrower and narrower as the series goes on, sadly. But in this one, it's just they just allow all the characters a good shot at it. And while Spock is a central character and pivotal, he doesn't dominate. And I think it works well for this episode that he doesn't. And often you've seen, well, you know, he rescues a load of episodes, but on this one, it's not. He plays it brilliantly, but it's an understated role throughout this.
It is understated, but it's also, he has a lot to do in here, and it shows more to do with Leonard Nimoy and his acting, because there are some bits where he trolls Stiles, where he sort of like goes over and peers over his shoulder and like pats the back of the chair, you know, as he's going past, and it's like, you know, I'm giving you the eye, mate. And he's trolling him, basically. He's stirring it up a little bit as well, Spock. He's not actually as innocent and as this as you would expect. And the idea that sort of like when they had the when they finally know about who they're fighting, and they had the war room conversation, which I thought was really good to get everyone. This was like a proper ship, you know. There was a lot of track that they didn't follow through. It felt like this was a proper organization. And then when they all go into the conference room and they're trying to work out what they're going to do, I mean, Spock takes the opposite of what you expected him for his advice to Kirk. I thought that was very good. I thought that, and it, you know, it threw, and it also puts him on the side of Star Wars as well, against his own captain. You know, there was lots of little bits here. It's great.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed that conference room scene, and like you, I kind of lament that that's clearly a decision that they went away from a direction, I should say, that they went away from in later episodes. It reminds me the episode quite a lot, and understandably so, of the Corbinite maneuver, because again, it's largely bridge based with conference room, but again, it has the ensemble, the bridge ensemble, all having their moments, having their bits in this episode, and it adds to it. I also like the fact that they've got a big book of comets as well, just lying around on the table. I thought that was a really nice touch for the far future. That actually, yeah, we've got a book here, and it's got. And I also like the fact that Spock's clearly read it as well, which is just a nice little character point as well, to say that, you know, this guy doesn't need books when he's got it all up in his head, and he's much smarter than you. I appreciate the little bit of humour that there was in his face as well, when his reaction to when he saw the Romulan. And a small part of me, having seen this so many times, wonders whether or not there was a part of him that's thinking, you know, there's stories about the Romulans being maybe Vulcans, offshoots, and that, you know, maybe when he saw the Romulan, maybe he was like, I'm not actually all that surprised. But that is almost certainly me reinforcing decades of franchise story behind that thing. There's no possible way. So I think this was the 10th episode or something like that. It's just, there's no way. So really interesting, interesting dynamic going on there. I agree. I just wanted very quickly to just get your take on a couple of lines from Kirk. I mean, actually, in fairness, you've already given me your take on one of them, which is the really great line, which I've mentioned before, and that's when Kirk upbraids Stiles for his bigotry.
Well, here's one thing you can be sure of, mister. Leave any bigotry in your quarters. There's no room for it on the bridge. Do I make myself clear?
You do, sir.
But there's also another one earlier in the episode where Stiles is talking about the Earth-Romulan War and about how, you know, members of his family had died in that war, and Kirk reminds him that it was
their war, Mr. Stiles. Not yours. Don't forget it.
Yes, sir.
And I find that really interesting because it was a century ago, and in our society now, we still very much commemorate our wars from that period of time, from further back. And I wonder what you, whether you guys have got an opinion on what they're trying to say, if anything, with that line, you know, the perhaps a desire to look forward, not reflect too much on the war. Graham, have you got an opinion on that?
Yeah, I think as far as American culture is concerned, I mean, if you go back 100 years from when this was made, then you're looking at the Civil War in America. And of course, that is something that people today bring up still now in American politics. And there is certainly underlying, it informs a lot of people's political views, in especially the southern states in the US. So that could be a reference to those sort of things, and especially with the bigotry line in this as well. So there is that. I think for me that's what I would say that this is actually looking at, rather than looking at foreign wars or foreign powers. But it could easily be turned that other way. I mean, you've got to think, at the time, Japan obviously had been effectively under US occupation and had been reintroduced to the world by the US. So the US had controlled everything as far as what Japan could and couldn't do. And so there is that sort of feeling that Japan was obviously a useful beachhead for America, should China ever get too powerful, or should any of the other Eastern Asian countries fall to communism. There is those things that layer upon layer on this. We can look into that and think, oh yeah, this is what the writer was going for when he was trying to tell this story. But really, he just ripped off a war film from 10 years earlier, didn't he?
That's right, yeah. The Enemy
Below. A couple of war films.
Yeah, but yeah. Especially The Enemy Below, so, yeah.
It's been essentially acknowledged that the movie is essentially a remake of The Enemy Below, a 1957 film starring Robert Mitchum and Kurt Jurgens, with a very young David Hedison and Doug McClure, for those of you who like your genre cinema. It's available on YouTube, this film, in its entirety. Go ahead and watch that if you want to. You want some further viewing. Absolutely. I mean, I don't know whether I haven't seen The Enemy Below, so I don't know whether or not it has its message. But I mean, it is. It's in terms of the adventure of the story, it is a classic submarine adventure, isn't it? Really, you know, Kirk is the captain of the frigate with the depth charges, and the Romulan commander is, you know, is the enemy submarine, you know, lurking. It's really on that side of the story. There's three different plot lines going on, and there's four different. There's loads going on so much plot going on, and look, you almost sometimes forget they have these little scenes interspersed with the Romulan commander, the Centurion, the Decius, the guy kicks out as well, and what's going on there. And just a few. I mean, we should talk a little bit about that, about how quickly those actors bring those characters to life.
Mm.
I would suggest to you that they use some very straightforward hooks, and for me, it reminds me of watching an old BBC Shakespeare. like watching Julius Caesar or something like that. I don't know whether or not you got that.
That's the thing I found, and also I lament as well from our meetings with the Romulans later on, because the language and, you know, the script that Mark Leonard had, he played it as Julius Caesar, you know, he did it in that way, and it was very, very Shakespearean. But, you know, it is an archetype that we could get straight away. I think that's the thing about this construction of this whole thing. There's lots of different archetypes that you get straight away that you don't need to explain too much, you know, and that's very good scripting. And I love the Romulans being a martial Roman type society, you know. As I said, we sort of lost that later on as we found more, and especially recent Star Trek, you know, lore, you know, they've turned into something completely different. But I love that sort of Roman thing that was going through it, you know. It was brilliant. I mean, it's sort of like, and as you said, he even played it as a gentleman officer, like, you know, your typical stereotype German U-boat officer who is has dignity and honor against his equal and opposite on the other side, which was Kirk. So it's got all of those little archetypes throughout. It's, you know, and you don't have to spell it out.
Yeah, Graham, I suppose what was the only thing that was missing from that dynamic was the fiendish member of the SS or the Gestapo obviously we do get that much later on with the Tal Shiar, don't we? I'm reminded of a Next Gen episode actually called Face of the Enemy, in which the Romulan commander is played with similar dignity, and it's the Tal Shiar who mess everything up. It's a really good episode. But Graham, yeah, Dale's right. There's lots of archetypes going on there. It's very, very comfortable for us. We can understand and recognise it. And when I say Shakespeare, I don't mean necessarily in terms of the quality of the narrative, the narrative of the dialogue. I mean in terms of the visual cues that we get and the kind of narrative cues that we get.
Well, yeah, because you look at that at the episode, and you've only got 44 minutes to tell this whole story. And there's a hell of a lot of story you've got to get in there, so you don't have a lot of time to develop characters. So if you can bring a feeling over by referencing familiar points. Remember, this is the age of the epic film, so there's lots of things like Ben-Hur that you can go on for your Roman influences. People watching this will be very, very used to that sort of like what they assume to be the Roman culture and the way that that operated. So it's great that you bring that in there. You have Romulus and Remus. You mentioned that. Of course, everyone's already tuned into it straight away. You don't have to explain it. And of course, over the years where you do have time to explore cultures and things, you do get the chance to actually go and mess it up a bit and introduce other aspects of their society, so round them out a bit more. And of course with the Romulans, a lot of the characterization of them sort of bled over into the Klingons from the TV series are less like the Klingons that you will see portrayed later on. And in many ways, a lot of the aspects of Klingon life have really been what you would assume to have been what the Romulans were when they were created. So yeah, I mean it's just really like, you know, especially as well with things like the Romulans and the Klingons, because of they were races that existed in the gap. In the big gap between the end of Star Trek and the beginning of the movies, and obviously the beginning of the Next Gen, that their societies were developed by fans. There's a lot of fan writing about them and that explains that expands upon them. And of course, people put their own stuff in. This is side canon, classic side canon material. And so you get, but the real winner in this episode is because of where it arrives in this sort of middle stage of the first series. It's like a lot of those episodes where the stagecraft of the actors is just amazing. It's just incredible. And the fact that the direction works really well as well. The costumes are fantastic. The lighting is superb. And of course, the music is brilliant throughout this episode. And all of that adds up into making something that is just brilliant.
You mentioned the music. I mean, that is that's original score, and refrain, that goes on. It's composed by Fred Stein, and obviously that goes on and is done and redone and redone all the way through, almost to the end of series three. Actually, that you get that music, and in fact, I was listening to Star Trek Picard soundtrack. And I noticed there was a teeny tiny refrain, but it was very, very clear, that same refrain that Jeff Russo had brought in. I did search the credits to see whether or not there was any reference to it, but it wasn't a mistake. It was very evidently there, because, you know, it was, and I looked at the caption, and it's the title, and it's like, you know, a Romulan scene. So, you know, hats off to Jeff Russo for observing that and bringing that in, and it's a testimony to just how enduring that music is. And I agree, it adds to just the general feel and the how polished that episode is. I think it also helps that it's a modest, in terms of its a budget, it's very modestly budgeted. I think I mentioned before, it's not quite a bottle episode. But it is effectively a bottle episode because the Romulan bridge is clearly a redressed set from the Enterprise. So, I mean, it's essentially a bottle episode, and it's extremely well done as well. And the lighting guys do a great job in just making it sufficiently different for us to believe that they are on another ship. I think it works really well. Let's discuss the relationship between the commander and Kirk. Very touching end to the episode where the commander elects out of duty and honor to destroy himself, but beforehand he says,
"In a different reality, I could have called your friend."
A pop quiz, you may get this, you may not, and unless our listeners are 80s comic geeks, they're not going to get there. And this is your cue. Where have you heard that line before?
Ooh, that's...
Well, I won't keep you any longer because it's boring to listen to silence. It's actually by Batman in the. Do you remember the miniseries Man of Steel? John Byrne's miniseries Man of Steel, yeah. When he rebooted Batman, Superman, back in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And Batman makes a guest appearance, and it's a Frank Miller kind of Batman. And you know, they have a strained relationship. They're not friends in the new DC universe. And at the end, John Byrne, who writes it, uses that same line from Batman to Superman. And
he's a massive Star Trek fan, isn't he?
And he is indeed a massive Star Trek fan, and has written and drawn a number of graphic novels on Star Trek, including ones about Romulans, which I can completely recommend. I think that the relationship between the Commander and Kirk adds to the kind of submarine aspect of it, the two foes who are apart but develop a bond between each other despite their distance and the fact that they will never meet and indeed are doomed for one to kill the other.
A doomed romance.
Yes.
Romance. Again, it's an archetype that people probably had as well before. You know, you had the good Germans in a lot of war films that have preceded all of this sort of stuff. But it is marvellously played between the two characters. I mean, they only see each other right at the end as well. You know, it's the idea that but there is that cat and mouse thing, but it's also the grudge and respect as he goes along, as as the captain of the Romulan ship, he's sort of being undermined or pushed in certain ways by the I can't remember the other character, the one who had the helmet on.
Decius.
Oh, yeah. Yes, because it's Decius. Again, a sort of Greek name, which, you know, when I first heard it, I thought it was
Greek-Roman.
Greek-Roman, you know, all the same thing. Aye. Yeah, you know. And, you know, but then he, you know, the idea that he's reluctant to continue on with the mission, and then after a while he gets the grudge and respect and also the fear against this other, Kirk, he's equal and probably more superior as well. In some, you know, it goes backwards and forwards a couple of times. He has a lot of doubt. He has a lot of, you know, the stuff about duty. It's multifaceted.
And, Graham, Kirk is in, I mean, the Romulan commander is obviously has the additional burden of knowing that his opponent is better than him. But I mean, they have this in common. They have this reluctance to go to war, this reluctance to fight. But that's the thing that they share, don't they? Because Kirk also, you know, is the tormented warrior in this episode as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is where it all gets a bit Cold War, doesn't it? Where it's like, it's like Secret War, isn't it? Where which is a theme utilized in the 50s and 60s, whereby the Russians and the Americans would be actually coming to blows against each other, but in a completely secret way so that they could not go have a full blown war. So that is played out there. But the way that Mark Leonard plays the commander is brilliant, and the fact that he's got a crew with him that have different needs, desires. They're not just drones. They're not just like henchmen, hired goons. He's got his own version of McCoy over there, which he interrelates with, and he's got some guy who has got powerful friends. So you're already seeing the multifaceted layering of these characters in just a few lines. You don't need to go on about it over and over again. I thought the scenes with the commander and the Centurion reminded me a lot of Pike scenes in The Cage, where he's in his quarters with the doctor, and you get that sort of thing there. And of course, the Centurion is really meant to be his version of McCoy, isn't it? He gets actually more screen time, I think, than McCoy gets in this episode.
But funny enough, I thought that McCoy actually had gone, his character had become Boyce for this episode as well.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
He was much more of the older advisor rather than the, you know, how
the country doctor,
the country doctor. He was there as advice and standing back and, you know, making not actual judgments, but, you know, pushing him on.
And bartender as well, because he uses it to customers, doesn't he? He says, I'll say this, I don't often say this to any of my customers. And clear callback to the Boyce thing going on there. Yeah, no, that's beautifully observed. And I just, it's just amazing just how much character byplay that you get within this small episode, particularly given that, as you point out, Graham, you know, a significant number of those characters we're never going to see again. And that indeed includes Stiles, because he's a great character for doing what he does, for being the metaphor.
Yeah.
Or, well, it's not even a metaphor, is it? It's pretty much on the nose.
Yeah.
For the object of that. I remember when I first watched this, and thinking that maybe Stiles would come back, because that it was that far back, and we're being a bit disappointed that we'd never see him again. But can I just ask, do either of you think there's a possibility that Lieutenant Stiles from Balance of Terror is the same character from The Search for Spock, Captain Stiles of the Excelsior?
No.
I mean, they're both dicks, I think.
Go with it. Make that the well, thing. I think that works well. Yeah.
No, it works for me.
Yeah, look, it works perfectly.
I think Stiles in this sort of, he grows in this episode, doesn't he? Because he goes through that sort of, as he goes along, and obviously with the end result of his relationship with Spock changes, you know, I mean, it gave that moral ending to his story.
Yes, although I love the way that Spock slaps him down in sickbay afterwards and said, what?
Well, again, Spock is actually trolling him.
Well, it's interesting actually, because I mean that brings us on nicely to the last little subplot going through, and that's of course the wedding. There's even a wedding in this episode, or not a wedding, sadly. There's a ceremony that gets I suppose the death of Tomlinson, who is due to get married, and then Kirk. The final scene is Kirk in the chapel with his what would have been his widow's, let's say his widow Angela, I think her name is, and a very clear message about the futility and consequences of war. But guys, extraordinary that they are able to use in 44 odd minutes just the economy of script writing to be able to get all of this plot, all of these different strands, all of these characters into this one show. I mean, they don't make many more episodes of Star Trek like this ever, arguably, do they?
No, they don't. I mean, in many respects, you look at this episode and you think, this is all just throwaway. This is all disposable to you, isn't it? I mean, you create this amazing Romulan commander and kill him off. This would never, ever happen in a TV series now. Yeah, you would. Mark Leonard's character would have been good for at least 4 seasons, and he would have been turning up every other episode. this guy. And no, 44 minutes in, that's it. You're not coming back. Well, if you are, you're coming back as Spock's dad, which makes it even weirder. Yeah. Which makes him looking at the screen and thinking, now that guy looks incredibly like my dad. I'm not going to say anything, guys, but.
Well, we weren't going to mention
it. Where was my mother?
Whoa.
I told you we're never going to speak about that. Sarek's long lost brother, of whom we never speak.
I think there's a lot of casualties in this episode as well, actually, because you're saying that sort of, obviously, the commander's gone, and unfortunately Tomlinson dies. But it also occurred to me, after this episode, Spock is still trolling Stiles, and he has a word with Kirk and gets him transferred to a different ship.
Yeah, that could be it.
Yeah.
You know,
It gets even worse for Spock, though. I mean, like, you know, he already recognizes the Romulan commander as his dad, and then he thinks, well, that's okay, that's all that the business out of the way. And then in a mock time, the rival for his girlfriend's affection suddenly thinks, hang on, weren't you on the Romulan ship as well?
Yes, you're quite right. Yeah, that is the case. It's the same actor, isn't it?
Yeah.
They all just cast the guys that we played for those Romulans in the last season. It's fine. Don't worry. No one will notice.
I have discovered something brilliant, though. It was I think at the end of the second season, when Spock was threatening to leave and wanted to get a big uplift in the money for appearing in Star Trek. And I think he was demanding a trebling of wages. And that Roddenberry put to go in, his negotiation tactic was to basically write three sheets of A4 of names of actors that he was going to get in to replace him. And this was list A, list, or there was an A list, there was a B list, and there was a C list. And Mark Leonard was the top name on list A. And Lawrence Montagne, I think it was the guy who was Decius, was on the top of list C. But actually, looking down on list A, I've got it here because it's in Inside Star Trek. At the bottom of the list is David Carradine on that list A. But if I go down, halfway down it is Edward Mulhare. Now, here's my quiz question. Now, do you remember who Edward Mulhare is from 80s TV?
Of course. I remember.
Go on, Terry.
From TV. Mulhare, I'm just trying to remember. I mean, he was also in films, was he, as well?
Oh, yeah.
Everyone
apart from one person on this planet knows who Edward Mulhare is. And coincidentally, they happen to be on this podcast, which is amazing.
Yeah, I can't remember. You'll say it,
So, Devon from Knight Rider.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, well, but you didn't say it there, did you?
Could you imagine if he took over as Leonard Nimoy in the third series? Yeah, so his name was down just a couple of rows down from Mark Leonard as a replacement to
I can see it. It wouldn't float.
But I mean, it's a point that you raise in fairness, because back then they still didn't realize, they knew that it was popular, obviously, because of the letter writing drive and stuff like that. But they had no idea just what icons these characters were going to be. And that, this was just a TV show. And that Mark Leonard, I'm sure, would have had no problems whatsoever in playing Spock in that third season, despite the fact that he played, Spock's father in, I mean, he would have been, whatever, it's a TV show.
Give me the script.
This is always a thing that I think is just worth bearing in mind about the when we go back over the quality of these episodes. Is that they are, this is the 60s and TV is trash. It's big money, but artistically, creatively, it's regarded as trash. To be able to make high quality stories, well made films like this, for what is essentially be regarded as just a trash medium, just speaks even more highly of the people who made it. And I think that that's why these episodes need to be. To be treasured. And it is also, I think it's a sad, because it's worth bearing in mind, Balance of Terror probably has the elements that would have been chopped up and then dropped into a 12 episode miniseries now. And then split out all the way along those. As you say, Graham, there's no way in a modern writer's room they're going to devise a character like the Robin and Commander and then just kill him in one episode, and which isn't going to happen. I mean, he's worth a double episode death scene alone, they will say. And that's great, but it also, I think it is, and it's not the first time we pointed this out, that there's a lost art to TV story making, to production, as a consequence of the stretching of plots and the serialization of TV shows. And I think that that's it's not a lost art, because we have plenty of good anthology shows out there, but it's shame that we don't see more of that. And it's heartening that there's talk that Strange New Worlds will be returning to a more episodic format, but we heard that before, so I don't know whether or not that would be the case. Chaps, usually around this time, one of you comes up with a blistering take. And I think that now is the time for the blistering takes. I'd like to stop quite soon. So if you have them, then, cough them up.
Well, I think you've already had mine in the fact that Sarek was a Romulan commander. But
I think that wins the blistering take. I actually do want to just quickly have a conversation about the Romulans and Star Trek going forward, because obviously we've found out that Strange New Worlds is going ahead, and I presume that sort of like this is set 10 years before TOS still, or 9 years, 8 years, whatever, we shouldn't have any Romulans at all in this, you know, this series. So because
yeah,
you know, this episode appears afterwards.
Yeah, they find ways of getting around that, don't they?
Well, I was a bit disappointed when they tried doing that with Enterprise all those years ago.
I thought whole Enterprise Romulan thing was ill conceived personally, but not the only thing that was ill conceived about Enterprise. But I mean, yeah, that trying to shoehorn them in despite the fact that they hadn't seen them and weren't due to actually be face to face with them. And they did okay, but that show is just anachronistic to me. The whole aesthetic of Enterprise is entirely wrong, and I think it made some bad judgments. And I still can't get over the fact that they tried to explain away how the Klingons lost their original regain. I mean, it's just an utter thing. Anyway, let us not turn it into yet another Terry Enterprise rant.
what I would say though is that this episode it does give us perhaps one of the greatest scenes in the movies as well, because let's face it, the last act of Wrath of Khan is pretty much lifted from this episode, isn't it? And well done because of that. And the whole fact that they only ever meet cross screens as well it works exactly the same way. Obviously, like the character, the relationship between the character is different, but there's a hell of a lot of echoing there, isn't there? And also as well, as you mentioned, Searcher Spock. I my hot take is that I wonder if they originally when they're originally coming up with the idea of Searcher Spock, when they had the Bird of Prey there, whether or not it was going to be Romulans rather than Klingons that they were going to use.
I believe I've read somewhere that there was an earlier iteration of the script in which that was the case, that they were going to be Romulans.
Yeah.
And that maybe that's where the Bird of Prey in the script still remains. I may have completely made that up, but I'm almost certain that I read that.
But
somewhere.
It just seems to make sense to me as soon as I caught that in my head, and I thought, actually, yeah, if someone has made that up before, then well done, and then because I can completely buy into that.
And the more I think about it, Graham, the more convinced I am that that's the case, that in fact it was indeed at a relatively late stage of production that they elected to change them to Klingons. I'm certain that that's the case. I'm sure that there are listeners who are more knowledgeable in that area, and they will and they can clarify that if they want to. And please do get in touch through the usual channels. Gents, I think we've spoken enough, and have no more speakings to speak about Balance of Terror. I think what we'll do. You mentioned Wrath of Khan, Graham. I think perhaps in our next episode, the time has come for us to do Space Seed.
Ooh, yes.
Because we are, for the time being, we're going to focus on some classics. We're just going to do some classics. And Space Seed is most definitely a classic. So why don't we do that? Derek, what do you reckon? You on board with that?
If I said no, it wouldn't make any difference, would it?
Well, we could invite somebody else on, I suppose.
No, we've been waiting for this for ages. I mean,
I've got a list. No. I've got three A4 pages of podcasters that I could replace you with, Derek.
Oh, have you?
Is David Carradine on it?
Yeah,
David Carradine's one of them.
Yeah.
Edward Mulhair is another.
Yeah. A lot of other dead guys as well are on
there. Yeah. Oh, charming.
Anyway, on that somewhat...
I'll get me cloaked then.
On that somewhat threatening and menacing note, we'll draw a conclusion. Thanks again for listening, listeners, and to Derek and to Graham. Thank you very much for podding with me. And until the next episode of Whom Pod Destroy, it's goodbye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.